It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Matthew Charles has seen this movie before. The broad smiles, the hugs, the taste of newfound freedom.
I'm humbled, I'm thankful, I'm grateful.
This time, he hopes he's home for good, walking out of a Kentucky detention center Thursday night after a combined 22 years in prison for selling crack cocaine. His 35-year sentence reduced retroactively, thanks to President Trump's First Step Act, a sweeping criminal justice reform bill signed last month.
So what's it like to be free? What's it like to walk along this river and see the trees? And
it's unexpressible in words. And I mean, it's something I've been dreaming about for close to 22 years now.
In 2016, he was released after the Obama administration changed sentencing guidelines for crack-related crimes. But the sentence was reimposed last year due to the court failing to account for prior convictions. Matthew yanked back to prison after spending 2 years rebuilding a life on the outside.
I was never bitter, never angry. I understood, you know, their perspective on what the law stated and what could be applied to me and what couldn't.
While serving time, he was a model inmate with not a single disciplinary infraction, a judge noting his undisputed rehabilitation. But legally, the justice system recognized just one Matthew Charles. His record also includes a slew of other felony convictions, including domestic assault, kidnapping, and burglary, making him a career offender.
Can you believe that that person existed?
When I look at it now, no, sir. I'm like, when I think back on it, I reflect on it. I'm like, wow, you know, I hate it.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That was a report from January 2019. It's been about a year since the Criminal Justice Reform Act, known as the First Step Act, was signed by President Trump. And the history of that is pretty interesting. As I look back on the disagreements on that, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, in conjunction with Van Jones, the self-described communist who frequented the White House during the Obama years, and the Koch brothers, who funded so much of this, worked together on this bill. Now, that's not all. It got more complicated because conservatives were deeply divided over this First Step Act. It was presented as this wonderful possibility to get people, especially people of color, men that are black, who've been incarcerated for unfair reasons. Maybe they've smoked, a toke of marijuana at one time, and that's what we were told. One-time offenders, and so there was going to be leniency. It's been a year. So what's happened since then? I've asked Daniel Horowitz to join us this morning because Daniel is the senior editor at Conservative Review. He also hosts the Conservative Review podcast on Blaze TV, which is also on YouTube and iTunes. Daniel and I go back a long way. Daniel is one of the most prolific writers and thinkers, really, in D.C. He is. And I can't think of anyone who's written more except for Senator Tom Cotton, maybe, about the criminal justice reform movement. And so I've asked Daniel to join us this morning. Good morning, Daniel.
Hey, good morning. Great to be back with you. It's been way too long.
I know, it really has, Daniel. I want to ask you what I just said. The First Step Act was enacted into law. It's been about a little bit more than a year now. And so one thing we're seeing is that black voters in America are supporting the president. The polls said a few months ago, 37%, which is just stunning. We know that the black community is very moved by this act on Donald Trump's part. So that's been what's happened in the black community. But the reality of what's happening in terms of crime and its danger to the country, that's what I want to talk to you about. What has happened, Daniel? Have things become better as we were promised in this last year in terms of of crime because of this reform bill?
So that's the one thing never discussed, Sandy. And notice from the clip you played at the top of the hour, I would just think that the police and the prosecutors just came in, everyone was minding their own business, and they just grabbed people and just locked them up, and they're the victims. There's no crime in this country. The reality is we never focused on the other side of the ledger. This entire movement at a state and federal level, and we could talk about the First Step Act in particular at a federal level, but I think it's important to begin the discussion by zooming out broadly about the premise that's undergirding this entire criminal justice so-called reform movement. It's all built on a lie. It's built on a lie about where the system is. It's built on a lie about what has happened over the last number of decades. The reality is that forget about low-level first-time, what's their language, nonviolent offenders. We don't even lock up enough of the repeat violent offenders. Every day at Conservative Review, we report on endless cases of murderers and rapists. Forget about even drug traffickers, who, by the way, are inherently violent, that barely serve time, that are out on probation and commit endless crimes and aren't reincarcerated. The pendulum has long swung back the other way, and we have all the data to back that up. But yes, crime has been going up in New York and Atlanta and Minneapolis and Chicago, Baltimore, San Francisco. Broadly, since 2015, we have been reversing the trend. And this is very important. You could plot this on a graph. In the 60s and 70s, the judges let everyone out. Crime was skyrocketing. Reagan came in, and this was, along with going after the Soviet Union, this was his top priority. People forget that. He put in place laws at a federal level. He also advocated for other things that unfortunately never got passed, but that spawned a revolution beginning in the early 90s, and violent crime and murder dropped by 60 to 70% culminating over a 20-year period. What has happened over the last 5 to 12 years, depending on the state, but certainly accelerating in the last year or two, as we're seeing in places like New York and San Francisco, is this criminal justice reform movement that has reversed that trend. That we have already, the prison population at a federal level is already at its lowest level since 1993, wiping out the entire baseline increase. In most states, like my home state of Maryland, the prison population is down 30%, even as the general state population has grown. It has already gone down. And guess what? Not surprisingly, we're beginning to reverse that trend. You look at New York, you're seeing the same problems we saw when Giuliani started to, deal with it. Subway crimes, assault are growing. Some places the murder rate is following quicker than others. The assaults and, vagrancy crimes and the, homelessness, the drugs, it's all back. What's shocking, Sandy, is that the same people who talk about, we lock up too many people, it's missed on them every day. The number of Americans harmed by repeat offenders because we don't lock them up. And let me tell you, law and order is a pro-life issue. Here's the deal. 70 to 85% of murders, depending on the state, the type of murder, are from repeat known offenders.
Wow.
A good chunk of murders in this country are avoidable. They are avoidable. Let's just take, for example, we'll get into more macro data if we have time, but let's just take some specific examples recently. Recently, we had two very high-profile shootings. One was the Jersey City attacker on that kosher store.
Yes.
And in the same week, the church shooter in Texas. Here's the irony. Both of them had massive histories, a dozen or so arrests, domestic violence, aggravated assault resulting in serious bodily injury, and numerous weapons violations. And it's very interesting. The same jurisdictions that want to say that peaceful, law-abiding citizens who pass a background check can't carry a concealed weapon, when you have people violently assaulting with firearms and who have already had prior convictions, they don't serve time in jail. So both of them, barely served a day in jail. Both of them had firearms violations. And it turns out the guy in Texas actually spent some time in New Jersey, and he was arrested on a firearms charge. And it was somehow diminished to a misdemeanor, and he didn't serve time. That he should have been in jail. He should have never been out on the streets to shoot people. Here's the reality of anyone who works in law enforcement or in prosecution or who lives in any normal community. No system is perfect. But for every one person you could show me who you think is over-sentenced, I could show you 500 people who are under-sentenced or never-sentenced. And I'm not even talking about drug traffickers. I'm just talking about the big four criminal categories. Yesterday, I have an article out. You can go to conservativereview.com, this case in Georgia. Where this is particularly problematic is with juveniles. Reagan warned about this all the time, and it's even worse now. Juveniles don't serve any time. And we're not talking about, a guy caught the first time for larceny, petty theft, and throwing him away for 30 years. We're not talking about that. This guy had 12 violent arrests, and he's only 17 years old. He was arrested the last time in May for carjacking, I believe with a weapon. And he was let out on very, very low bond. 2 days later, he was arrested for grabbing a female jogger and brutally assaulting her to the point where it looked like he was going to kill her, raped her. Luckily, a good Samaritan came in and fought him and until the police came. This guy was just offered $50,000 bail, even after that. These are the stories the media and the virtue signalers in the state legislators, in Congress will never talk about. There's never a balanced discussion over the trends, where we are, the fact that we've already had so many leniencies built into the system, second, third, fourth, fifth chances, that crime is going up now that we've already experimented with this. Because, again, remember, Sandy, a lot of them are acting like it's 2002, it's 1998, like the peak of incarceration. That trend has long since been reversed.
Daniel, let me ask you something. Yeah. Look, you're talking now, clarify this. The First Step Act, it was sold to us because I remember sitting there having it sold to me and rejecting it. AFA actually came out against it. I want to make that clear. But the selling point was that these are low-level drug offenders. No one talked about really these violent criminals that you're talking about. And here's a letter signed by people that I respect and like, friends of mine, who were all about it. And in the letter that they sent to President Trump before it was actually passed, they said, we as conservatives strongly encourage you not to be swayed by misguided rhetoric by opponents, but to continue support for the legislation which focus on recidivism reduction will enhance public safety by reducing crime. And then it goes on to say that our nation will be safer. We will be safer if we pass the First Step Act. Now, what is it that they thought they were... There's a lot of people that you respect, too, that are on this list. Let's come back in a second and talk about the First Step Act in particular. And if that's a result, you're broadening the swath, I do want to talk about criminal justice reform in general, which you have done, because we have just a continual accelerated push to liberalize everything surrounding criminals. There's just no question about that. So let's clarify about the First Step Act. I know they want to introduce another act because this has gone so well, and we need to talk about that as well. My guest is Daniel Horowitz. Again, he's the senior editor for Conservative Review, and you can see him on Blaze TV with Conservative Review podcast. We'll put that on our Facebook page so that you can see it. We'll also post his latest articles for you to read on our Facebook page. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Live stream video captures the moment a gunman wearing a dark hoodie emerges from a back pew, drawing his gun and firing inside this Texas church during Sunday morning service. The gunshots sparking panic in the pews. Worshippers seen ducking for cover. One man covering his wife with his own body. 6 seconds into the shooting, two members of the church security team returned fire, hitting the gunman, dropping him to the ground. The 911 calls came shortly before 11 a.m.
Active threat, 1900 South Las Vegas Trail.
Inside the church, at least five other parishioners pulled out handguns and carefully approached the fallen gunman. One man kicks away his gun and picks it up.
It was a sad thing that he had to come into the congregation and hurt people, and it's a sad thing that we had to hurt him.
We're going to need help with patient care.
Two churchgoers and the gunman were killed.
The citizens who were inside that church undoubtedly saved 242 other parishioners.
One woman said her mother, a longtime member of the church, saw the suspect and noticed something was wrong.
The shooter was sitting next to my mother. She knew from growing up in the church that she didn't recognize this gentleman.
Outside, law enforcement secured the area as parishioners, visibly shaken, consoled one another.
We lost two great men today. But it could have been a lot worse.
Today, evil walked boldly among us. But let me remind you, good people raised up and stopped it.
There is no word on a motive this morning. According to authorities, the gunman has had run-ins with police in the past, but no details have been released. Leaders here praising the actions of those church members as heroic for stopping this attack so quickly.
All right, that was ABC News. The report of that church shooting, that was West Freeway Church of Christ, what, not even a little bit more than a week ago. Man, the news comes so fast. So many serious things happening, and it's very difficult to keep up with. But Keith Thomas Kinnunen was the shooter, and we know now that he had a massive rap sheet. My guest Daniel Horowitz has written about that. He, again, is the senior editor of Conservative Review. Daniel, this fits into the whole category. This wouldn't be something as a result of the First Step Act. This is a result of just the broader move to lessen punishment of crime, would you say?
Sure. So yeah, let's talk about the First Step Act. This case is not, but what it is in all 50 states, the political elites of both parties, which increasingly seem to be kind of like a unibrow, melding into one, it's built upon the same premise. And we don't have time to debunk each one, but it's a bunch of false premises of, number one, that people are locked up a long time for low-level drug offenses. Then number two, it's disproportionately blacks, and they're disproportionately locked up over and beyond the rate of crime that they commit. And number three, a misunderstanding of fundamentally what's in the federal system. So with the First Step Act, if you talk to anyone in law enforcement, you start saying federal drug trafficker, low-level offense, they'll start snickering. And the reason is this. Reagan started talking about this, and it's true today. The federal system is not just different, but it's for more severe people. It's a backstop to the state system. So what Reagan called for, and he understood this very well, is that they saw a bunch of gangbangers and murderers and responsible for a good chunk of the murders, let's say in places like Baltimore and Chicago. And they kept getting let out, and they barely served time. So what they would do is they would come on the back end and hit them on three things, one of three things: RICO, racketeering, firearms charges, or drug. That's how they got them in the federal system. But they would only target them, again, with exceptions of, you know, prosecutions run amok, but for the most part, these are the people with 12, 15 state convictions that have been targeted because the federal U.S. attorney works with local law enforcement to take the guy off the street. So, for example, Kate Steinle's murderer, what was he hit up on? Ultimately, firearms charges. But what was he? A murderer. So many of the MS-13 people that you hear in the news were caught, you know, butchering people, cutting up bodies. A lot of them even initially are only charged with RICO, drugs, or firearms. And certainly they wind up pleading down. And this is the key. Because of the 50 ways from Sunday that the federal courts have created holes in the Constitution for them to get out of convictions, prosecutors have to take a plea deal. It's a whole other deal. You have to look at their sentencing report. What is their history and what were they initially arrested for? All of them plead down. So here's the deal. A U.S. attorney doesn't have the time to go after nobody's in there for possession. That is a fact in the federal system, really in the state system too, these days. The federal system for simple possession, they're drug traffickers, and usually they're big leaders, they're gang members, and they're responsible for murder. A name you need to know that you're not going to hear is Joel Francisco. He was a guy released earlier this year, and I'm sure there's many more, but you'll never hear about it. The only reason I know about this is because there was a good reporter in Providence, Rhode Island, that reached out to Cotton's office for comments. He wouldn't have known about it if not for this guy. So Joel Francisco was a Latin Kings leader. I actually wrote about the Latin Kings in the lead up to the First Step Act, noting how many of the drug traffickers are Latin Kings members. Very violent transnational gang, although it does have some, you know, Americans involved in it too. And basically, this guy he was convicted on the three strikes and you're out for drug trafficking. But this guy was responsible for so much of the murder in Providence, Rhode Island. In 1998, he pled no contest to taking a gun and execution style, pulling the trigger on someone's head. Somehow the guy didn't die in the end. But, you know, he pled no contest. That's the type of guy this guy was. There are numerous people like that, because that is the rule, not the exception, of who U.S. attorneys go after. So he was let out earlier this year. A couple months later, he was arrested for murder. And by the way, intermittently, he was caught violating the terms of his parole, coming to his former girlfriend's home with a knife. I think there was another incident, was never put back into prison. Because again, this is all driven by the lie that we so badly can't add to the prison population that we have an over-incarceration problem. Yeah. I want to read some statistics to your audience that are very important to demonstrate at least some of these lies. 60% of those even in state prison, which again are lower level relatively to the federal system, are serving time for murder, rape, assault, robbery, or burglary. Okay? So, and that is four times the number of those convicted on drug offense. So it's not the drugs that's fueling the large degree of incarceration. It is violent crime, and unfortunately, we have a lot of it in the country. Yet, even as it stands now, without the more robust jailbreak policies that they're pushing, less than 15% of state felon convictions result in more than 2 years' time served in prison, even 20% of those in prison for murder, and nearly 60% of those in prison for rape or sexual assault serve less than 5 years. Only 15%, yes.
No, I want to ask you, this is fascinating, and I could let you talk forever, but I want to ask you about personalities. We have two personalities involved in this push to bring reform to our criminal justice system. One is George Soros, and one is, it's a couple of people, the Koch brothers, the one surviving, I guess. And Soros
and
pardon?
There's a third element, the growing progressive evangelical and
yes.
Catholic leaders that that say that the Soros agenda is God's word.
Yes, exactly. Well, but I'd like to talk for a second about Soros using his money to put in position these radical prosecutors. Can you just say a word about that?
Sure. So again, you as a conservative, you have to look at everything in totality. You can't look at one thing. You can't get sucked into their talking points. As you well know, this is a matter of dismantling the system at every stage. It's mm-hmm. having left-wing prosecutors to end prosecution. It's at the evidentiary standard. It's creating more loopholes so they can't nail conviction. It's not locking anyone up pretrial, abolishing bail. It's reducing sentencing on the back end. It's juveniles. It's police tactics. It's every stage. It's even technology. that has really allowed police to catch more people. They're going after that as well. Every last stage. So the prosecution is one part of it, because what better way to have than having a wolf in sheep's clothing, have a public defender type as a prosecutor, and then you don't do anything. And what a lot of them are starting to do is turn over information about witnesses and victims to the defendants that they shouldn't have, you know, their addresses and phone numbers. One of the things prosecutors tell me, I always ask them, why is it you can never land a conviction commensurate with what the guy did? I'm telling you, I see this every day. 90% of people are not convicted on what they did. I see every day the cases of those that break into multiple homes and rape three children, and in the end, it's residential burglary and no rape charges. Every day this happens, and they say the biggest problem is witnesses. It's very hard to get them to come forward. So if you understand the Soros agenda designed for anarchy to ensure, basically to abolish the concept of incarceration, everything they're doing is designed to ensure that as few people as possible can land in prison. So what they're doing is they have witness intimidation. New York just passed this, where they abolished the concept of a secret grand jury, where the proceedings remain secret, not forever, but at least until the trial. So here's a brilliant thing that they're doing. Look at the amalgamation of the two policies they passed. Number one, they abolished pretrial bonds. So all these people, so for example, all the beatings, you severely beat someone on the street, you're out immediately without having to post any bond.
On the street, you're saying. You're out on the street again. The street. No bond.
Now, hold that thought. Yep. Hold that thought. At the same time, the same law that New York just passed that did that, brilliantly, in their perspective, designed it so that the defendants will now have access to all of the information immediately about witnesses and victims. And they're already seeing it.
So dangerous.
You know, these women assaulted. I mean, how often are you going to want to deal with that? The guy's out there right away.
Horrible.
It's not a bug. It's a feature.
Okay, but we have to move. Now, that's great. We could do a whole hour on that, but let's move to the Koch brothers. What in the world? They spent so much money getting the First Step Act passed, and many of us wondered about people that we know and trust, what their involvement was with the Koch brothers and why. What is the Koch brothers' motivation on this from your perspective?
They're libertarian anarchists. They're progressive libertarians, not conservative libertarians. The Koch brothers view America as a corporate spreadsheet, and that's all they care about. They don't care about culture. They don't care about security, safety, sovereignty, national security. So it's the same reason why they are rapidly for open borders, for endless illegal immigration, sanctuaries, refugees. It's also another thing is it's become a rite of passage in the business community. In order to assuage their guilt with the left that they earn a profit in their businesses. So the same reason why you have to support the homosexual agenda, you have to support Planned Parenthood. That's the same reason why you have to virtue signal about illegal immigrants, about refugees, and now about so-called criminal justice reform. It's become one of those virtue signaling issues.
Yeah.
That is only signaling with no virtue.
Daniel, probably 3 or 4 months ago, I was I won't even say the people, I just had a conversation of a key person in D.C., and he told me that the Koch brothers and Soros are combining now to form a think tank to counter and defeat Donald Trump's policies. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know a specific think tank. I think it's openly being done in almost every single so-called conservative think tank supports it. Look, I mean, I can go on and on about how much of a broken movement we have, and there's also Soros money funding certain evangelical groups too, by the way.
Yes, and let's talk about that. Yes, I know about that. So let's talk about the evangelical.
I mean, I just want to say, Soros, obviously, Soros is a godly man. I mean, a lot of colleagues of ours are telling me, well, he's right on the border. He's right on refugees. He's right on crime. I mean, I guess he's really a good guy. I mean, I guess he has biblical values.
He must. Yeah, I'm with you. tongue in cheek, I'm with you, because people will take this literally. But I do want to say, we only have a few minutes here left. I do want your, I have plenty of thoughts about this, but I want yours on the evangelicals that are really contributing and embracing all of this. I'd be the leaders of the Southern Baptist ERLC. We've got Catholic Church. We've got the Colson Center. We've got 30 seconds. Anything you can add about that?
In this era that we live in with social media, the left has successfully defined morality, their immorality, as morality. And it's all about virtue signaling. So they've just jumped on board. Again, it's the same reason that they're all writing letters to bring in endless Islamic refugees, both Sunnis and Shias. It's the same reason they don't give a about the 2,500 deaths at the hands of illegal aliens every year in sanctuary cities, but they complain about treatment of illegals at the border. I mean, we have a crisis of values and a crisis of intellect, even on our own side.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very well said. Daniel Horowitz of Conservative Review. Onward and Upward, you can see Daniel on Blaze TV with Conservative Review podcast. And so, Daniel, God bless you. It's great to talk to you again, and we will talk again soon, I hope. Thank you. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
As you see, there has been criticism from the Republicans about the briefing that was put forth yesterday by the administration on this subject. Some have asked, do you agree that this is the worst intelligence classified briefing that Congress has received from this administration? As some of you have heard me say, there is stiff competition for that designation of worst. So here we are to protect American lives and values. We are passing today a war powers resolution to limit the president's military actions. The administration must de-escalate and must prevent further violence. America and the world cannot afford war.
Oh, yes. So Nancy Pelosi is doing everything she can to undermine national security, certainly to undermine the president's efforts to push back on Iran. And the House has passed this piece of legislation that she has proposed to restrain the president on his actions against Iran. In the Senate, Tim Kaine is introducing a piece that's going to actually force the president to stop any kind of attack or any kind of retribution or interaction with Iran in 30 days. So they've got it all worked out. And she was speaking about that briefing that actually happened 2 days ago. That briefing that had very different reports. The Democrats, of course, came out of the briefing saying it was horrible, and that the Republicans said that they felt that they were convinced that it was an imminent threat, as though they needed to be convinced of that, but they did. It was interesting to hear Mike Lee's response. Senator Mike Lee was quite angry when he got out of that briefing, and we played the clip for you yesterday, but let's revisit it today. Here it is.
With history as our guide, consultation isn't necessarily the same thing as authorization for the use of military force. A declaration of war or an AUMF is what the Constitution requires, and drive-by notification or after-the-fact lame briefings like the one we just received aren't adequate.
Yeah, so Senator Lee was quite upset. Overview of his remarks, he starts out by saying he's still a strong supporter of President Trump, but the briefing was very inadequate. It was only 75 minutes, and he was I've never seen him so angry. Remember that Senator Lee is a libertarian. He's also a constitutionalist. So his defenders are saying that he's looking at this strictly from a constitutional point of view. His detractors, of which I'm one of those, are saying, if you have a problem with the briefing, why would you go public seeing the big picture the way things are? We're in an unusual time where we have never had a Democratic Party whose leadership, and not necessarily the American people who are Democrats, not the broad swath of them, but certainly the leadership and the members of the House have so thoroughly gone to the left that they constantly undermine this country and make it clear that they want to see the change. They want to see, you know, that radical transformation Barack Obama talked about. They are undermining our safety in every way they possibly can. Why would we hand them some public statement like Senator Lee just said? He also ended it by saying he will support. He wasn't going to support Senator Kaine's proposal to stop the president from being able to do what he needs to do with Iran. But now he's going to support it. That's what he said yesterday. I thought it was pretty upsetting. Let me just talk about this War Powers Resolution. Andy McCarthy wrote a thorough informational piece in Fox News, and I want to share a bit of it with you. So he talks about Senator Kaine's resolution. It would purport to direct President Trump to cease hostilities with Iran in the absence of congressional authorization. Now, listen carefully, because we have conflicting rules and regulations and laws. The Article 2 of the Constitution makes the president the commander-in-chief. And incidentally, if you go back to the Civil War, the Supreme Court held in this particular case, it was called the Prize case, that when the United States is under attack, the president has not merely the constitutional power, but the duty to use whatever force is necessary to repel the attack, regardless of whether Congress has permitted the use of force. Okay, so that's been one of the only times that this has come up since the Constitution was written, making the president the commander-in-chief, who obviously had to prosecute wars. I mentioned yesterday that Abraham Lincoln actually stepped in to act as the general in the Civil War when he was having so many problems with his generals, no one he could trust. So that's where it stood 100 years after the Constitution was written. But along comes the Vietnam War. And the Vietnam War, of course, was undermined by radical leftists. I have a very different opinion of the war. I lived through that era, watched it very carefully. I have a very different opinion than what is the general understanding of that war. I think it is absolutely the truth that we could have won that in a heartbeat. We went in there because the communists were invading from China into Vietnam, trying to take over that country. And we knew that communism was a huge threat to the world. And so we went in to try to stop communism from taking over Vietnam. It's as simple as that. And so we were on our way to winning that when the left and the media started doing what they're doing now. You know, Walter Cronkite, you know, announcing the body bag count every night, denouncing the generals. And so the media jumped in on this. But at the time, you know, I'd never seen the media do anything like this. They started destroying the commander-in-chief. They hated Richard Nixon. And there are a lot of theories about why that is. And I'm not saying he was perfect. How would I know? How would I know if Nixon's perfect? I know about Watergate, yes. But in the scheme of things, it probably wasn't as big as what they made it. I'm just saying. And the media jumped on this and they took the president down. Man, they took him down. So they had the cooperation of a lot of leftist radicals who were the thought persons within the ranks of the anti-war movement. A lot of, maybe some of you listening were anti-war, anti-Vietnam War and marched in the streets. Some of you grew your hair long, you burned your draft card. That did not mean to me that you were, that it's not synonymous with being a leftist communist agitator. You probably, based on their arguments, believed that they were right, plus you didn't want to fight in a war. But there were those who were stirring this up who knew exactly what they were doing. They were the instigators. We know this because, well, for instance, David Horowitz, who's a good friend of mine, was one of those, and others were busy purposely using this problem, as communists always do, and leftists, taking a problem and stirring it up, turning people against each other, agitating, in order to destroy the system and take power. That's the way it works. So these communist long-haired marchers on the street who were, you know, whispering in your ear about what was happening or not happening in Vietnam, a lot of it propaganda, some of it true, but we could have won that war if it had not been for the turn of the American sentiment by the press on our people. So those people, you know, the people that marched in the streets in the 60s and 70s, the organizers did not prevail. They were turned back. They really lost that battle. It was a terrible time in our country, I have to tell you. But what they did was they cut their hair and they ran for Congress. And many of them won, as they won so handily that they actually took Congress over. So in 1973, One of the first things they did was pass the War Powers Resolution. Now, that's what Nancy Pelosi's talking about, some addition to this War Powers Resolution. This was not passed till 1973. It's not a piece of legislation. It's a resolution. And what they wanted to do was to stop President Nixon, who was still in office, from prosecuting the war. This was late in the war, and they were trying to hamstring him in any way they could. So these former hippie liberals who had cut their hair to look respectable started wielding power in the Congress. That was the same group of people that in the 80s, in the church committee hearings, crippled our intelligence agencies. Now, how could I say that? I think you'll remember if I tell you that after 9/11, after the attack on 9/11, our intelligence agencies took quite a hit because the accusation was that they were not cooperating. They were not sharing information. But what you didn't know was the reason they weren't was because of the church committee. In the early 80s, those long-haired, no longer long-haired, former hippies who won, like Patrick Leahy. I mean, there was a whole group of them, huge amounts of them, enough to take over. They were able to do all this stuff to the church committee and separate the ability for these intelligence agencies to share information and work together. That's why they couldn't work together before 9/11. They weren't allowed to. Did you know that? Probably not. So now the War Powers Act comes out of that era, 1973. And according to Andy McCarthy, since that time, all presidents have sort of, or most presidents have claimed to, you know, have blustered about being consistent with the War Powers Act, but literally did not heed it. And Barack Obama was no exception. He took the absurd position, Andy says, that his unauthorized, unprovoked attacks on Libya, remember when they killed Muammar Gaddafi, were too piddling to be considered a war or a use of military force. So they claimed that he was abiding by the War Powers Act, that action just didn't apply. That Libyan action. And indeed, of course, it did apply. If it's going to apply anywhere, it applies there. So let me read further from Andy's article. The WPPA reports to bar the president from ordering our armed forces into battle unless there has been a congressional declaration of war, a specific statutory authorization of the use of military force, or an actual attack on the United States or its forces. It calls for the president to consult with Congress before ordering our forces into hostilities and to report to Congress within 48 hours of so ordering them. If Congress does not authorize military action within 60 days, the War Powers Resolution says the president must withdraw our forces. So Andy goes on to say it's probably unconstitutional because it is an abuse or a contradiction to the Article II powers that give the commander-in-chief the ability to use military force when its vital interests are threatened. So Senator Tim Kaine's resolution, which he will be introducing in the Senate, would direct the president to stop any military action against Iran within 30 days unless Congress authorizes it. So where would that put us, I ask you? Where would that put us? And, of course, now we know that if the president were to ask Congress, he'd be asking the head of the Intelligence Committee, who is that? That's Adam Schiff. This is an absurd situation. That's why I was very upset with Senator Lee for coming out and making that statement. I think was in politic. If he had a problem with the briefing, he could have called them privately and said he had a problem with the briefing. But his knee-jerk reaction was to say he's going to work with Tim Kaine on this War Powers Act, this additional resolution. I think that's irrational and dangerous, and I don't approve personally. Hans von Spakovsky was on Fox kind of explaining his position on the War Powers Act. Let's listen.
This is a meaningless political document intended to embarrass the president. Look, the president has very broad powers as commander-in-chief under the Constitution to defend the nation, and Congress cannot put limits on his decisions and determinations about terrorist threats and how to use the military to respond to them. That's his decision alone. The Constitution does not contemplate Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Adam Schiff as a group of commander-in-chief mini-me's who can help make that decision or limit the president. Again, this resolution and those provisions are meaningless. Congress can't put on those kind of limits. If the Congress wants to not provide the money through the power of the purse, that they can do. But they can't direct the president to cease or terminate particular military actions constitutionally. They just don't have the authority to do that.
All right, so that's that was Hans. And of course, they're not listening to Hans von Spakovsky, and they're not listening to anyone. The president weighed in on this and said, before the vote, hope that all House Republicans will vote against crazy Nancy Pelosi's war powers resolution. Also, remember her speed and rush in getting the impeachment hoax voted on and done? Well, she never sent the articles to the Senate. Just another Democrat fraud, presidential harassment. And I think he's right about that. I think it is presidential harassment. I guess that's a kind word for it. What they're trying to do is undermine the president of the United States on all of his constitutional authorities. They're trying to damage him in any way they can. They're trying to block him. Remember the term? Resistance. They are the resistance, and they are resisting him at every point. The problem is our people don't understand what a horrendous battle this is. I think they're beginning to get it a little bit, but I still think some of them are clueless. They don't understand what's really happening here, and therefore they naively try to, you know, land in some middle ground that pleases all their voters, but does nothing but further damage the president's authority. And the president's authority is necessary in this case to make us safe. That's all I have to say about that. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. In spite of this, we have so much to be grateful for. And so let's thank God and continue to be vigilant. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.